This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Anti-tobacco spending goes up in smoke.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From APM in New York, good morning. I'm Jeremy Hobson. A report out this morning finds states are expected to collect record revenue this fiscal year from a 1998 settlement with the tobacco industry, about $26 billion. But only a tiny fraction of that money will be used to prevent people from smoking. Our senior business correspondent, Bob Moon, has the story.
Smoking causes some of the most painful and deadly cancers. Quitting is much less painful.
Ads like this used to be hard to miss.
Quit smoking today.
But a new report from the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids finds that while states are taking in record revenue from the landmark tobacco settlement, they're spending less than 2% on prevention. The numbers are telling. Compared to the $8 billion annually that tobacco companies still spend on marketing, states are only spending around $500 million a year on anti-tobacco campaigns. That's down from nearly $750 million at the peak a decade ago. The report finds that many states are using the money instead to plug budget holes or fund programs unrelated to tobacco, the reason the settlement allowed states to spend the money on whatever they want to. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
It's been just over a year since Michael Woodford lost his job as the CEO of the Japanese camera and medical device company Olympus. He'd been in charge for just 2 weeks when he started asking the board some tough questions and was fired. He's just written a book about the experience called Exposure, How I Went from CEO to Whistleblower, and he joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, so first of all, take us back to the moment when you realized that something was wrong at Olympus.
I had heard that the company had made some very mysterious and strange acquisitions. And this was in an obscure magazine called Factor. And the first time I challenged the chairman, Mr. Kikukawa, and Mr. Mori, the vice president, we'd had a meeting scheduled for lunchtime. And the atmosphere changed when I got the magazine out, because I flicked through five pages and there was great detail about these three Mickey Mouse companies we had bought. They had no turnover, but we'd paid $1 billion, and that money had flown through the Cayman Islands. And I looked at Mori, and to the point where I said, "Who do you work for, Mr. Mori?" And I thought he would say, "I work for Olympus, or I report to you, Mr. President." But he didn't. His anger snapped, and he looked at me in the eye and said, "I'm working for Mr. Kikukawa." And it was at that moment that I knew there was something horribly wrong at the top of this corporation for which I was responsible.
Some of this is about corporate culture. Some of it is just about Japan and how things work in Japan. So what have you learned through all of this about the Japanese business culture?
After a month following my dismissal, the share price of Olympus was down 81.5%, yet the Japanese institutional shareholders would not utter one word of criticism of the incumbent board, or conversely, one word of support for the ex-president who was going through purgatory trying to get this out. And that silence, that deafening silence, tells you everything you need to know of why the Japanese capital markets are dysfunctional.
What would you say to a CEO in this country who's facing a similar situation where they realize that something is terribly wrong and they need to tell the board that something is terribly wrong and has to be fixed, but they know that there's going to be retribution, they're probably going to lose their job, and maybe they'll even face threats as a result of being a whistleblower?
I think whistleblowers are moving from seen to be sort of unsavory. They're telltales, they're snitches, to actually whistleblowers are good people in the society. And in my own case, you know, I was made Businessman of the Year in the Financial Times, Sunday Times, Independent, even the number one tabloid.
But as the outside world is heaping praise on you, it must have still been difficult, and there must have been moments when you regretted coming forward and causing such uncertainty in your own life.
You start walking along that bridge, you know you can't walk back. So I never regretted it. And the thing which haunts me most is not, you know, Kikukawa, who's now admitted his guilt. It's the friends who you thought were friends, the colleagues you worked with, who supported you, helped prepare the case. And then when you get fired, they suddenly back away
disappear
and run with the pack. And that is a very haunting and disturbing thing to go through.
Michael Woodford is the author of Exposure: Inside the Olympus Scandal, How I Went from CEO to Whistleblower. Thank you so much for talking with us.
It's been good. Thank you.
And let's do the numbers. Stocks are mostly higher in global trading this morning, up 0.1% in Singapore, almost 1% right now in Frankfurt. On Wall Street yesterday, the Dow added 82 points to close at 13,034.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace Music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg is asking for help figuring out what to do with the city's payphones. Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
There are still more than 11,000 payphones in New York City. And even though they aren't used as much as they used to be, they're still big moneymakers, says city official Stanley Shore.
The city has enjoyed a substantial amount of revenues from advertising on the payphones.
Still, with fewer people using the phones, the kiosks have become targets for vandalism. So the city's looking to turn payphones into hubs for some kind of public service and profit. The city's teamed up with companies to turn some of its phones into touchscreen stations, with tips for tourists, restaurant recommendations, and lots of advertising opportunities. Tom Touche is the CEO of City 24/7, one of the city's partners. He says payphones make an ideal spot for digital services.
You already have power, so you don't have to dig. All you have to do is bring broadband, and it's generally easier to do that in a place where there's already communication lines existing there.
Contest submissions are due by February 18th. In New York, I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Well, while we're talking payphones, I hadn't used one of them in years until the morning after Hurricane Sandy hit here in New York City. Cell phone service was out, and it was the good old-fashioned payphone around the corner that allowed me to communicate with my Marketplace colleagues. Well, once they finally accepted the collect call charges, which did take a few tries. In New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is the Marketplace Morning Report. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.